Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, everyone, to New Books in History. This is Ryan Tripp, your host. I'm here today with Martin Jay. He is Sidney Hellman Ehrman Professor of History Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. This year, he published Splinters in Your Eye, Frankfurt School Provocations. Welcome to the show, Professor Jay.
Thanks for having me. Great pleasure to be here.
So let's just start off with preliminary questions, and we'll get into more specific arguments as we proceed. So the book was published by Verso, and one of the early arguments in the book is, why did Georg Lukács refer to the early Frankfurt School and the circumstances of its founding as the Grand Hotel Ab Gunt, even as members initially pursued an imminent critique of society and lambasted the search for origins, foundations, and these kind of founding moments as both theoretically problematic and politically suspect?
It would take a long time to explain all the background of that. Lukács was himself present in 1922 at the first Marxist work week, which gave birth ultimately to the Frankfurt School. He was among the figures there, Karl Korsch, Frederick Pollock, a number of other figures, Karl August Wittfogel, and even Richard Zorge, who made his reputation as a spy. So he was, in a way, part of the larger intellectual formation out of which they came, a formation that later became known as Western Marxism, distinguished from its more Orthodox communist, Eastern Marxist alternative. But, and this is the crucial reason why he ultimately criticized them, he remained a communist. He remained within the Communist Party of Hungary, and then during even the Stalinist period, always maintained allegiance to the Soviet model, and was very desperate to avoid what he saw as the impotence of intellectuals who left the party or were never a member of it, who tried to be free-floating or outside of political engagement. And the members of the Frankfurt School fit that latter description. They were, for the most part, politically non-engaged. That is to say, they were intellectuals who tried to be above the fray. They were not, in most cases, party members. Some briefly went through party allegiances in the early 20s, but most of the significant figures did not. And so Lukács basically had scorn for leftist intellectuals who were not able to find a way to unify theory and practice. Radical theory, yes, critique, yes, but practical impotence, practical non-engagement. And critical theory, therefore, from his perspective, was self-indulgent. They had enough of the comforts to live in a grand hotel looking down at a world that was understood in an apocalyptic fashion, looking into the abyss, but they had no ability to link up, from Lukács' perspective, with the one movement, a Leninist movement, that would ultimately be able to move us back from the abyss. Now, they themselves understood that they had what might be called a political deficit, that they could not find a link between theory and practice. But they also recognized that what Lukács had done was sign a devil's pact with the party, sacrificing some of his intellectual independence, some of his theoretical integrity, and became, in a way, prisoner of a party that claimed to represent the realization of Marxist theory, but in fact had in many ways betrayed it. So there's a kind of tragic dimension to the Frankfurt School's long history, tragic in the sense that it understood that a critical theory needed to change the world, needed to be effective in the world, needed to connect theory and practice, needed to realize what Marx had argued in the 11th thesis and Feuerbach, that interpretation was somehow ultimately not enough, and yet also understood that in the present world, there was no clear way to unify theory and practice, no clear agent, no clear historical subject, no clear meta subject that could somehow create the new world after a meaningful revolution. So they retreated into what Jürgen Habermas was later to call a strategy of hibernation, waiting for some sort of practical possibility to occur, waiting for objective conditions to change. Lukács, more impatient, more committed to change now, scorned them, therefore, as pseudo-intellectuals, as phony intellectuals. Bertolt Brecht shared that, although he was very different in his attitudes towards many things from Lukács, he nonetheless shared the scorn that the Frankfurt School basically were what was sometimes called a parlor or a salon Marxists, people who were willing to talk, willing to criticize, but not willing to act.
So for our listeners, this is a collection of essays on the Frankfurt School, and we're going to be relating those essays back at the later in the show to the title, Splinters in Your Eye. First, I want to address certain arguments, though. How and why did arguments by Frankfurt School members, including Jürgen Habermas's later depiction of Gunt as one out of many justifications for truth claims, which Martin Heidegger ultimately resisted, how did this adhere to certain ideas promulgated by Friedrich von Schelling, particularly his critique of the absolute union of existence and essence, subject and substance, without embracing the irrational? And if possible, can you also compare and contrast Frankfurt School ideas with Hannah Arendt's assessment, if any, of Grund, fatality, as well as multiple founding moments?
Okay, we have to step back a bit. I mean, this is a very vexed and complicated philosophical and political issue, and I can't do justice to it in a few sound bites. But basically, the problem is this. In the famous essay on critical and traditional theory, Max Horkheimer, in 1937, had argued that a critical theory basically did not accept the status quo, did not accept the facts of the world as inevitable, did not accept the naturalization of history as somehow unchangeable, and instead argued for a position which basically imbued those facts with values that criticized the status quo and pointed towards an alternative future. So then the next question that had to be asked was, what was the ultimate standpoint from which that value critique was launched? What was the ultimate, we might call it foundation or Grund or ground, from which critique could be made? Is it simply the arbitrary opinion of somebody who is critical? Is it simply a kind of subjective and therefore, basically not very binding alternative to the present? Because there are obviously lots of those that can be, made with absolutely no ability to persuade. So then the question was posited, what is the normative foundation of critique? What is the normative basis which will persuade people that it's not simply subjective opinion? Now, the Frankfurt School had to struggle with this issue, and I'm not sure they ever fully resolved it, but basically they had to consider several alternatives. One was the alternative that we might call objective scientific or philosophical knowledge, which has no relation whatsoever to who holds the knowledge, to who has the superior vantage point. So here it's a kind of what might be called contemplative objectivist view, in which science, or what the Germans call Wissenschaft or philosophy, or something that gives you a superior insight into normative alternatives. And for example, natural law theory thought that you could use nature as the standard by which you measured critical potential. So this is one position, but they ultimately felt this was too abstract, too objective, too dispassionate, too basically external to the world in which they and everybody else was grounded. So then the question is, are there particular vantage points? Are there particular standpoints? Are there particular places in the world which give you some sort of purchase on normative critique? And Marxism traditionally argued that the proletariat gave a certain advantage over bourgeois or let's say so-called free-floating intellectuals, because the proletariat represented in concrete material terms within the current totality a potential to be a universal class that would in the future represent all of humankind. And therefore the vantage point of the proletariat, the ability to argue from within the experience and the practice of the proletariat, was the source of superior Grund or vantage point. Now, here too, the Frankfurt School basically had abandoned this position because, from their perspective, the proletariat was not fulfilling the theoretical potential that had been ascribed to it by Marx, that it had lost its way and was no longer possibly a potential universal class. So this left them without a viable normative vantage point. Now, from the beginning, however, and this is where a figure like Schelling rather than Hegel comes in, there is a philosophical awareness of the difficulty of going back to the Ur or the initial origin, the initial point from which critique is launched, as if there were a moment that is temporally anterior to the moment from which we are observing the world today, that we could somehow base our critique on that moment, the moment of original insight from which we have fallen. And Adorno in particular seems to have become skeptical of the search for that moment of origin, the moment of ground. Grounding is a kind of architectural metaphor that you have a foundation upon which you build an edifice. You have a ground upon which you create something that transcends it, or something that goes above it as a form out of which something meaningful can be construed that will have a critical edge. So Adorno ultimately, and he more than the other figures of the school, found, I think, in a kind of indirect way, in Schelling's critique of the possibility of origins, of the impossibility, really, of finding an Ur moment, an Ur ground, let's call it primal moment before the fall into history, that it was impossible to find that philosophically. And there are lots of complicated reasons, theological as well as philosophical, that this was impossible. That instead one needed to have, if you stay with the theological, an apophatic philosophy, which is a philosophy that is one of negation, which can't name anything positive, which can't name anything that is somehow complete and transcendent, but always can only give and gesture towards negative descriptions of something which is impure, something which is not yet fulfilled, something which anticipates a reconciliation which it can't depict. So Adorno ultimately argued against what he called the mania for foundations or grounds, turning that idea of living on the edge of the abyss, the Lukács notion of the Grand Hotel Abgrund, into a virtue that we don't need to have points of origin. We don't need to have absolutely firm normative grounds to make critique. And if there is a ground at all, it's an anticipated possible future, a moment of pacification, redemption, whatever fancy word you want to use for the end of the debilitating contradictions and antagonisms of most of human social relations and human history. So the ground such as it is becomes not a firm ground in the past of foundation, not a firm ground even in the present of normative solidity, not a standpoint, but some sort of yearned for alternative in a future which is yet to be achieved. Now, this is a much more tenuous ground, a much more, we might say, vulnerable and volatile ground. But ultimately, I think the Frankfurt School understood that it was impossible to come up with an absolutely firm ground, either in transcendent ahistoric critique, such as natural law theory, or even in immanent critique, in which one measured the standards, the goals, the norms of this society against the actual practice. Even though, to be sure, it often did use immanent critique in its analysis. So for all of these reasons, it struggled with the need to find a critique. And the later generation of the Frankfurt School, epitomized by Jürgen Habermas, sought an entirely different answer in his understanding of communicative interaction and the notions of universal pragmatics and speech theory, which is something I don't discuss in this book, but which was at the center of my previous book on the Frankfurt School's struggle to come up with an idea of reason, reason after its eclipse. But that's an entirely different story, which I think we probably would be wise not to try to spell out now.
Well, on that note, for our listeners, so one of your chief contributions to historiography was the dialectical imagination, something I'm familiar with. Can you please provide for our listeners the research background to that Harvard dissertation, which became the dialectical imagination in the early 70s, including your early meetings and correspondence with members of the Frankfurt School, how latent internal conflicts and deaths affected your research, the fallout from your question on the school's ethnic origins, and their concerns over the initial working title, Permanent Exiles?
Okay. I gather that we're not talking about my own background in researching my dissertation that became the dialectical imagination. It's so long ago, it's now more than 50 years since I began the dissertation back in 1967. Basically, I was interested in two things. One, the intellectual migration from Germany to the United States, which was then for the first time gaining a kind of scholarly interest. Many of the emigres were still alive and were interested in creating an historical account of their experiences. And so I knew a few of them and became especially interested because my then dissertation director, H. Stuart Hughes, was friendly with many of the others. He had been with Franz Neumann and Herbert Marcuse and others in the OSS. The second interest was trying to make sense of Herbert Marcuse's work. In the 1960s, Marcuse was a very, very influential figure in the New Left. And I had read Eros and Civilization, One Dimensional Man, and knew about his work from friends who had studied with him. But I had no inkling, really, of the background of the kind of continental Marxist theory out of which he had emerged. And so I was very curious about the somewhat exotic source of his ideas. At that time, you have to understand there was very little American, Anglo-American understanding of what later became Western Marxism. I contributed an essay on Horkheimer to the collection edited by Carl Clare and Dick Howard called The Unknown Dimension, which had essays on figures like Gramsci and Sartre and Althusser and others, who were almost completely unknown in the United States as Marxists. Anyway, the connections that Hughes had with people like Marcuse, with Paul Lazarsfeld, made it possible for me to gain access to many of the figures who were still alive and who allowed me then to see in certain cases, especially Lowenthal and Paul Lazarsfeld, some of the materials they had collected. I went to Germany in 1969, a very fraught and difficult period in the history of the school. Adorno was much beleaguered by his students. Habermas was also, at that time, much younger, but nonetheless still an important philosophical giant and political figure in German thought, also much beleaguered. And I went and spoke with Adorno without much success. He obviously was suspicious of someone who would come with modest understanding of his ideas, which was indeed my case at the time, and felt that I had only what he called a nose for the dirt, and so gave me little help. But then I went to to Montagnola in the Lugano area, the Ticino area, rather, of Switzerland near Lugano, where I spent a lot of time with Horkheimer and Pollock, and they were very helpful, giving me lots of time and answering many questions. Of course, Horkheimer then wrote a very helpful introduction to the book. It was complicated partly because I was also aware of different memories, different interpretations school members had of their own experience. The most obvious case was Eric Fromm, who granted me several interviews and was very helpful in responding to the chapter I wrote on the Frankfurt School in psychoanalysis. Fromm had broken with the school, was very hostile to Horkheimer and Adorno, had really gone in a very different direction. And my own inclination was to be more sympathetic to the Marcusean version, the Adornoian version, we might say, of critical theory than Fromm's. But I didn't want to neglect his contribution. And so I hope the book succeeded in showing how crucial Eric Fromm was to the original constitution of the Frankfurt School's work on Marx and Freud. And there are other figures as well. Lazarsfeld's role, for example, was disputed by Adorno and so forth. There were lots of tensions that I became only sometimes even dimly aware of, sometimes more acutely aware. But I tried to follow a precept of Hegel's, which I thought was very useful in giving me a sense of proportion. Hegel once said that no hero is a hero to his valet. In other words, if you know all the dirt about somebody, know all the human, all too human aspects of their work, their lives, you realize that everybody has feet of clay. But then Hegel added, that's not because heroes are not heroes, it's because valets are valets. In other words, the heroic is still there despite the human, all too human qualities that make them human. And a valet who is only interested in, somehow the disputes, the personal personal conflicts, the very, in some sense, unheroic qualities of the heroes, one then fails to recognize that they have something that still can be seen as heroic. And so I tried to make sense of the work and tried to make sense of the legacies rather than the conflicts and the personal disputes, which I learned about but didn't want to foreground. So, the book, of course, began a long train of much more detailed and much more nuanced interpretations, both of their lives and work. And I have always felt that, my own account was a preliminary and initial account, which was more stimulus than a concluding account. It was never intended to be the definitive account of their legacy, and I'm happily happily surprised by how much has happened since I initially wrote it.
How did Max Horkheimer's introduction to the Family of Man photographic exhibition at the 1958 Frankfurt America House entwine mimetic empathy and certain aspects of a Kantian perspective with liberal American intellectual traditions? And how did these arguments compare with his Fate of the Individual and Democratic Families in the earlier, the 1957, Concept of Man?
I think it's a kind of curious thing, this Max Horkheimer relationship to the Steichen Family of Man exhibition. It's curious because it goes against what he argued in his introduction, goes against many of the more critical remarks that Horkheimer, Adorno, and other Frankfurt School theoreticians made about what might be called liberal or bourgeois humanism. They basically were suspicious of what they saw as the ahistorical, anthropological, and even ideological function of humanism. They were very much anticipating what might be seen as the more recent post-structuralist, even postmodernist critique of a simple bourgeois humanism. But in that particular moment in their history, 1957, when Horkheimer was asked to introduce, in 1958, the Frankfurt America House exhibition that Steichen had first put together in the United States in the Family of Man, he was arguing from a somewhat different perspective, a much more pragmatic one, based on the need to, in some ways, reestablish a kind of liberal humanism in a Germany, which for 12 years, from 1933 to 45, had damned humanism in general in the name of a biologistic nationalism, which was obviously hostile to universalist values. So using the family of man as a, you might say, ideological tool, he argued for liberal Kantian values of cosmopolitanism and universalism, argued for the idea that somehow all of humankind, no matter what the ethnic or religious or other identity of various members might be, that every human needed to, you know, somehow be accorded dignity, and that it was possible for this visual manifestation of that to be understood as in the service of that goal. Now, what also makes it ironic is that the Frankfurt School, and we briefly mentioned this, I guess, before, was critical of the idea of using images to express utopian utopian possibilities. That is to say, an image of a paradise or an image of reconciliation was something they wanted to avoid. Following the famous Bilderverbot, or Jewish taboo on images, which goes back to the Bible and its prohibition on making a graven image of God or a graven image of, you know, in, say, even the Islamic tradition of humans in general. So basically, what the Frankfurt School had always argued was that images by themselves are insufficient alternatives to names, concepts, to language. And yet in this exhibition, there are, of course, images of families and of people doing things in daily life and working and leisure activities, which suggest a kind of human commonality. And in this one case, Horkheimer backed off the ideal of the Bilderverbot and said, no, images mimetically can show, can represent, can make immediate the ways in which humans are part of a larger family. He also accepted, in a way, that metaphor that human beings are members of a family, a metaphor which had been abused by the Nazis, who talked about the national family and talked about a people's community and talked about things that were, in a way, quasi-organic and biological. So in many ways, this was a very anomalous intervention that Horkheimer was making in that introduction. But what makes it understandable is that in the context of a Germany, post-Nazi Germany, that was trying to gain its footing as part of the larger, let's call it Western world, I hate to say, you know, the free world, but because there were so many ways in which the West was not yet free, but at least was trying to avoid falling back into either Nazism or being seduced by communism, he decided for tactical reasons to promote what in the larger theoretical context of his work and the work of the Frankfurt School in general, they would have probably been more comfortable condemning as ideological.
Despite the gendered and racial implications of Horkheimer's advocacy for ties of kinship between all members, quote unquote, of the human race, how did this introduction emphasize the critical potential inherent even in the, quote, most insidiously consolatory ideological formations, such as the critical work that the concept of essence might do when it is transformed from an eternal truth into an essentialist normative potential to be realized historically?
Here, the crucial question is the ambivalent, we might say, or ambiguous, be a better way to put it, potential of a philosophy of essences, a philosophy that says that there is something beyond superficial phenomenal differences, differences of appearance, something which is shared, a concept that unifies, that in a way makes identical that which is non-identical. Now, in most respects, the Frankfurt School, and Adorno in particular, and his idea of negative dialectics, was critical of conceptual essentialism, of finding some sort of concept under which one could subsume particulars, under which the non-identical could be commensurated into the identical. And yet, and this is why they're always dialectical in the sense that they constantly find alternatives in a very different direction from generalization. And yet, essences could also be understood. And this was an argument that Marcuse had made as early as his 34 or 5 essay on the concept of essence. Essences could be understood not as existing inherently, naturally, eternally, as concepts which under which the particular, non-particular, non-identical are subsumed, not as already existing, but rather as normative potentials, as ways to conceptualize a future which was, as Ernst Bloch would put it, not yet. And so the family of man represents a kind of human brotherhood or human solidarity or human, generalized dignity, which doesn't exist now. Humans, alas, are now in antagonistic relationships to each other, are divided by ethnic, class, religious, and other ways to split us into warring tribes. But if we assume that there is something called a family of man, and you know, despite the gender implications, let's say a family of humanity, we have the potential maybe to aspire to that condition in which everyone is given equal status. I mean, it's the idea of an equality of dignity, an equality of recognition, an equality of condition, ultimately, which allows us to realize individual potential. So it's not something which should be celebrated as essentially there now, that everybody has this, no matter what their empirical conditions are, but as a normative goal, one which can be seen as never fully achieved. There's always, let's say, an asymptotic approximation, which is never fully realized, but which nonetheless gives us a standard by which we can measure the present as inadequate. It comes back basically to the old idea of immanent critique, which, as I said earlier, was one of the potential sources of grounding value. Immanent critique in the sense of we believe there is a family of man now, but reality shows that there is not yet one. And therefore, we measure the model of the family of man, the model of human shared dignity and equality. We measure it against the inadequate reality, which, alas, has not yet achieved it. But we hope, because we have not yet given up that ideal, that we can move in a closer and closer approximation to what we hope will be a future condition.
What were the impulses and consequences for Erich Fromm, Max Horkheimer, and the Frankfurt School's wedding between cognitive Freudian psychoanalysis and historical materialism, even after Fromm's break over such psychoanalysis and the commodity fetish?
The source of the Frankfurt School's, what is often called marriage of Marx and Freud, of historical materialism and psychoanalysis, the source of that is multifarious. First, they were very much, interested in trying to explain the failure of the working class to achieve its ascribed goal of being a universal class, and wanted to understand the deeper psychological mechanisms that allowed working class people to somehow accept authoritarian rather than emancipatory political solutions, or simply to be nervous about change and accept the status quo. So that was one source to explain the failure, we might say, of the working class. A second source of their interest in marrying Freud and Marx was an understanding of the appeal of fascism. Fascism as something that Marxism had not fully anticipated. I mean, one might argue that in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, Marx had talked about some aspects of proto-fascist authoritarianism, but really had not fully plumbed its psychological basis. So psychoanalysis gave the Frankfurt School some weapons, we might say, in the search for an understanding of the sources of the fascination of of fascism that made it so crucial a challenge to Marxism. Thirdly, they understood that fascism was, that psychoanalysis was in touch with a what might be called a deeper layer of human existence than that which was conducted on the level of reason, even of language, understood as communicative on the level of spirit, that it got us in touch with the body, with materiality, with what constituted the deeper layer of human desire. And so there was something in psychoanalysis that was consonant with the materialism, we might say, of Marxism. It was a materialism of the body, a materialism of the suffering body, the body in pain, as well as the desiring body. And as a result, psychoanalysis gave them a vocabulary to deal with what might even be seen as the utopian potential of a redeemed body, one which would not be repressed or would not be a body that was ascetically denied. And of course, Marcuse in particular was to pick up this aspect of psychoanalysis when he wrote Eros and Civilization, and tried even to reverse the notion of a death instinct, reverse its pessimistic implications, and give it a utopian reading in a very, let's say, speculative and complicated way. So psychoanalysis was a potential tool for a rethinking and expanded thinking of the materialism of Marxism. It was not, however, and this was one of the things that differentiated them from Fromm and from psychoanalysis in its more orthodox understanding, it was not a therapeutic tool in the present. That is to say, the Frankfurt School was never interested in using individual therapy, using psychoanalytic therapy as a way to cure the suffering of individuals in bourgeois society, in contemporary society. They thought ultimately it simply made people accommodate themselves to the status quo, and therefore had an ultimately conservative implication. So although Lowenthal and Horkheimer had their own personal analyses, Adorno, Marcuse, and the other members of the school had not, and they were very skeptical of the practical use of psychoanalysis for a therapeutic tool, something that, of course, Erich Fromm promoted, and one of the reasons why they ultimately broke with Erich Fromm.
So Theodor Adorno is often known for his quote, "In psychoanalysis, nothing is true except the exaggerations." So how did this pretty off-quoted statement attack Freud's dichotomy between reason and pleasure, yet also question whether Herbert Marcuse's call for a life-death dialectic and a nirvana principle to overcome surplus repression, how did this could and should absolutely reconcile pleasure with reason, given non-identity, or at least Adorno's non-identity, as prefiguring a social order?
Adorno's position on psychoanalysis is a very complicated one. As I said earlier, he was hostile to the therapeutic implications of psychoanalysis, use it cognitively rather than as a tool to reconcile people to their to the current situation, make them happy, make them cured, make them well-adjusted. He also had a certain skepticism towards the more utopian version of psychoanalysis that Marcuse promulgated in Eros and Civilization, in which the death principle was basically reinterpreted as seeking a state of non-agitation beyond experiences of capitalist society, a state of blissful nirvana, which would allow somehow humans to achieve a kind of tranquility in the world. Adorno always, I think, felt that there were tensions that could not be fully overcome, fully tranquilized, we might say. So that one of the things that he held out for was we might say, Hegelian negative dialectic, in which various elements such as reason and desire, spirit and the body, Geist and Natur, subject and object, that the tensions between them were maintained in a non-antagonistic constellation rather than what Hegel would have called aufgehoben or sublated into a fully harmonious and reconciled higher third. So that Adorno's position about psychoanalysis is that it helps us to see the benign tensions between ego and id, between reason and desire, rather than try to find, this Marcuse thought, a way in which reason and desire could be fully and completely integrated and reconciled. It's in some ways a more, we might say, realistic and even tragic, if you want to give it a slightly negative connotation, more tragic position than the fully comic response, comic in the sense of fully reconciling opposites that we find in Marcuse. It's a utopia that is a utopia that accepts difference, non-identity, tension as potentially valuable without believing that a full pacification of existence can ever be achieved. And so that was his somewhat, I would say, delicate integration of psychoanalysis without it being fully and completely integrated in the sense of Marcuse's reconciliation of reason and desire.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If you can, please briefly discuss Leo Lowenthal's role in the Weimar Jewish Renaissance, his ephemeral engagement with Orthodox Judaism, and I guess demonology, his portrait of the Jewish poet Heine, compared to Adorno's and Habermas's portraits, his approach to Karl Marx's Jewish question, and his distancing from any conception of unpolluted Jewish purity.
Leo Lowenthal was, with Eric Fromm, the only serious, for a while at least, observer of Jewish orthopraxis, who later became a member of the Frankfurt School. I mean, he, in the early 1920s, was very much a rebel against what he saw as the watered-down, assimilated Judaism of his father, of his parents' generation. And he shared with many people in the immediate post-war era, post-World War I era, a fascination with the more extreme mystical and anti-Enlightenment or counter-Enlightenment dimensions of the Jewish tradition, which were at that time being discovered in the Hasidic Eastern Jewish traditions that German Jewry had left behind. So Lowenthal was a figure who was searching in the early 1920s for some sort of alternative to what he saw as the dry, desiccated, assimilated Enlightenment Judaism of a long tradition of accommodation to things that he felt were basically bourgeois and unrevolutionary. Now, as the 20s wore on, he began to lose his faith that this was a valid alternative. So although flirting with Zionism, he never really became a serious Zionist. Although a much involved member of the circle around Rabbi Nehemiah Noble in Frankfurt, who was a charismatic rabbi who died prematurely in the early 1920s, after Rabbi Noble's death, he didn't continue Lowenthal did not continue with his observant defiance of his father's liberal assimilationism. However, he remained very interested in Jewish thought, and during the 1920s, at a very young age, wrote a series of quite remarkable texts on various German Jewish thinkers, including people like Freud and Marx and Heine. And from Heine, he took a very interesting lesson. Heine's divergence from the assimilated Jewish tradition had led to his conversion to Christianity. And many people saw this as a kind of Jewish self-hatred, an apostasy, which was cynical. Heine had talked about it as buying the entrance ticket to European civilization. Lowenthal saw it in a more forgiving way, as an expression of Heine's disappointment with assimilated Judaism, and as an attempt to remain true to the more revolutionary and universalist and, in some sense, still relevant aspects of the Jewish tradition, which could be harnessed for more radical, even materialist purposes. And so Heine's apostasy was not against Judaism, but against the assimilated, watered-down version that Lowenthal himself had also abandoned. And then Heine later became, we might say, disillusioned with his conversion, and recognized that he had debts that he could not fully repay to the Jewish tradition, which he had apparently left behind. And Lowenthal also, I think, validated that aspect of Heine's rebelliousness. The same might be said about his approach to Marx's famous, or rather infamous, essay on the Jewish question, an essay which has often been understood as an expression of Marx's sometimes anti-Semitic or at least self-hatred relationship to his own background. Marx, remember, had come from a family of Jewish rabbis. His father had converted. Marx had no Jewish training and no interest, as far as we can tell, in Jewish theology or Jewish practice. But nonetheless, in that essay, especially in the second half of it, had denounced the Jews as inherently lustful after money and equivalent to capitalism per se, and one had to free oneself, emancipate oneself from the Jews, understood, or from Judaism at least, understood as equivalent to capitalism, exchange principle, market principle, and money. Now, what Lowenthal argued was that basically Marx's repudiation of Judaism was really, once again, as it was in the case of Heine, an expression of the deeper Jewish traditional desire for justice, traditional desire for redemption, which manifested itself in a critique of capitalism, critique of bourgeois society, which was then identified, alas, with the Jews. Now, what he neglected to say, and others have recently, I think, made this clearer, is that what Marx also understood in attacking what he called the dirty Jewish practice of being interested in money and so forth, was that Marx was also arguing for the importance of material concerns, of material practice, of the importance of redeeming the body, understood as dirty, but in fact, a body that had its needs, a body that was not simply to be spiritualized away. So that when Marx talked about in the Jewish question that Christianity was the sublime version of what in Judaism was simply vulgar, he was not, in fact, supporting the idea of the sublime as superior to the vulgar, but was reversing that trajectory, reversing that hierarchy. I was arguing that the vulgar, the Jewish vulgarity, we might say, was in fact bringing the Jews closer to the demands of the material body, the suffering body, the desiring body, against a kind of a Christian spiritualization which denied the body, was too idealistic and not materialist enough. So this was a version of materialism that needed to be preserved, even in its base form. And that Marx, in a complicated, indirect, and perhaps not fully coherent way, had gotten in touch with that. And I think Lowenthal understood that in his critique of the idea of purification. The Jews themselves, I mean, this is a complicated issue, the idea of keeping kosher and so forth, very interested in purity. But nonetheless, there is something about this being in touch with the body, being in touch with the needs of the suffering body, that allows the Jewish tradition to be seen as a bulwark against an overly spiritualized, overly idealized, overly anti-material understanding of redemption. I think Lowenthal, in a way, was anticipating that understanding of a base materialist reading of Marx's essay on the Jewish question.
Please compare Hans Bubenberg's pre-reflective life world, as well as ostensive metaphors and non-conceptual myths for those incomprehensible circumstances, with Adorno's apophatic emphasis on the non-conceptual object, conceptual realism, and what you refer to as magical nominalism. If you can, please also discuss both of their critiques of Martin Heidegger's being, as in, quote, equiprimordial unity of the conceptual and non-conceptual, as well as differences between magical nominalism and Platonic or eternal essences.
This is an extraordinarily difficult question to do justice to, because both Blumenberg and Adorno were thinkers of incredible subtlety, and virtually anything I say will be a kind of caricature of their position. But I think both of them were aware of what might be seen as the necessity but insufficiency of conceptualization. What I mean by that is a conceptualization, that is to say, the subsuming of non-identical particulars under essential categories. Conceptualization was necessary, that it was impossible to function in a world that necessitated human stratagems of self-preservation, impossible to function in that world without using language to create concepts which yoked together distinct particulars. And yet, concepts could also be construed as the domination of the particular, the domination of the non-identical, the domination of the preconceptual in ways that basically did not do justice to the inherent individuality and irreducibility of what was being yoked together under the concept, what was being essentialized, what was being turned into a mere example of something else. So both of them tried to argue for the value of the balance between conceptuality and non-conceptuality or unconceptuality, or that which escaped from the concept, that which was in excess of the concept, that which could not be completely exhausted by the concept. So then the question is, well, what is that other of the concept? What is the non-identical? What is the thing that, or the excess, or whatever you want to call it, very difficult even to give it a term, what is it that is beyond? And here they thrashed around really to come up with alternatives. So in the case of Blumenberg, he was fascinated with various strategisms in language, metaphor, myth, the anecdote, all ways in which human culture provided basically attempts to avoid the ways in which concepts were dominating and constraining. So metaphors gave us analogies. They gave us paradigmatic examples in colorful imagistic language of what could not be simply tamed or domesticated by overarching concepts. And he argued that they were absolute metaphors that could not be reduced to concepts. They were not preliminary versions of concepts, which then could be simply forgotten. You also argued that myths, even though they sometimes seemed fanciful and were based on a kind of early version of human attempts to make sense of the world, based on animistic and personalized agencies rather than real natural forces, myths also presented a kind of alternative to logos as a dried and desiccated rational way of making sense of the world. Anecdotes also, because they were paradigmatic examples of something which could not be turned into law-like regularities and given overly abstract meanings. These were all alternatives to conceptuality, and he thought they were irreducible, that they could not be forgotten or overcome. Once they lost their ability to function, they then were simply replaced by other metaphors, other myths, new anecdotes. So this was his version of non-conceptuality. It was basically one that stressed the importance of the subjective cultural interpretation of the world, which provided stratagems for dealing with a hostile, what he called absolute reality. Adorno had a slightly different emphasis. Adorno emphasized the resistance of objects to human subjective constraint. He argued for the existence of the non-identical in a subject-object as well as intersubjective constellation of elements. The ways in which the world always somehow resisted human control. To come back to psychoanalysis, this meant that the body, the human desiring body, the human libido, let's put it in its crude psychoanalytic form, could never be completely constrained by either the superego or the ego. Desire could never be constrained by the spirit. The somatic could never be completely controlled by rational intentionality. So there was a kind of it, an id, as it or s in the body, which was not the the ego, the ich, not the I or the subject. And as a result, it was possible to see in the natural world as well a resistance, the external world, to the human domination of it, that we saw it with the domination of nature. And so for Adorno, there was a difference not between simply concepts and metaphors, but also concepts and the objects under which were under the metaphoric attempts to constrain them. And I call this in another essay, which is not included in this collection, a kind of nominalism, which argues for the importance of names which do not somehow allow themselves to be subsumed under concepts, under generic terms, under abstract terms, names which are like proper names, which respond to the individuality of a thing in the world. A name which is like the name of a dog, Fido, which refers to this particular dog rather than dog per se. And I call it magical because, unlike traditional nominalism, which emphasizes human conceptual construction and the use of names that are named by the subject who names them, it's magical in the sense that the names are the names of the actual object prior to human giving. So in the terms of what Walter Benjamin called his theory of names in themselves rather than the names that humans give, these are the names that are there in the Garden of Eden, we might say, the names of ultimately given, I suppose, by Adam. They're Adamic names. They're the real names, the actual names, the true names, the names that are prior to the conventional giving of names after the fall into the cacophony of different languages, the fall with the Tower of Babel. Now, this is all highly speculative stuff, depending on a certain version of theology, the idea that there are real names, the idea of names that are not given but are somehow intrinsic proper names which are not generically attributable and so forth. One has to be very careful about, buying this entirely. But at least the idea is that Adorno wanted to argue for an inherent quality in the world which needed to be respected, and that therefore his utopia was a constellation, we might say, to come back to that metaphor, a force field of collective subjectivity, human solidarity on the one hand, individual subjectivity, you and me as irreducible to a generic subject, and also the objective world, the world that speaks back, as it were, the world that refuses to be destroyed by a dominating concept. And his version of non-conceptuality was the resistance of that world of objects, the resistance of the non-identical objective world to subjective, either individual or intersubjective or collective subjective imposition. And so whether or not this could be understood in terms of names or understood in terms of images. Usually he applied the Bildungsverbot here, that images in terms of immediate perceptual imagination was insufficient. This is something that one could debate. And when we talk about Benjamin on color, we'll see that there was another alternative to that. But basically, this is the direction that Adorno, I think, wanted to go, stressing the resistance of objects to subjects, the resistance of things to the world of conceptual or even metaphoric domination, linguistic domination of things themselves.
So let's talk about Walter Benjamin. What was the emancipation of color from the tyrannies? And first, how did such emancipation configure the Blau Auteur, the Blue Rider work of Wassily Kandinsky and semiotic codes of color? And then in contrast, why, for Walter Benjamin, before and after 1914, what was the child's view of color that, quote, defied categorization?
Benjamin's fascination with color, which was at its height fairly early on in his career in the 19-teens, represented one attempt to overcome the tyranny of concepts that I've spoken about a moment ago. And in terms of the history of art and the history of attitudes towards color, this was expressed in two different, or maybe more than two different ways. First, the valorization of color as opposed to form, design, shape, the idea that color, which was normally seen as closer to the body, closer to the senses, whereas form was closer to the intellect, that color should be seen as either equivalent to or perhaps in certain respects superior to form. So the color needed to be emancipated. Color emancipated from its hierarchical inferiority to form, but also color emancipated from its adherence to the experience world of representation of an external reality, so that color need not be simply the colors that we perceive. It could be colors that could be emancipated from that necessity that we might say enslavement to perception. So color is emancipated in that sense, but there's also an emancipation of the experience of color from what might be called its linguistic categorization. As I say, we think of the rainbow as having the basic colors, red, orange, yellow, green, indigo, blue, and violet. And we think of other colors that we've given names to in various languages. And we know, of course, if we look at the various ways in which the rainbow of colors is broken down in other languages, that there are various, we might say, alternative ways to cut into the continuum of color, to say that this is a color that has its own integrity and deserves a name of its own. What Benjamin was fascinated by was the fact that color, before it is named, as the experience, say, by children prior to their entrance into language, color is continuous through a series of infinite gradations, that it's not broken up by discrete names, not categorizable. And although Wassily Kandinsky did attempt to see a spiritual dimension in particular colors, Benjamin was far more interested in the ways in which color was on a continuum that could not be reduced to linguistic categorization. So that it was basically a kind of aconceptual and in some ways even utopian alternative to the domination of a certain conceptual categorization, type of thing we've seen in both Blumenberg and Adorno when it came to non-conceptuality. Now, ultimately, Benjamin moved away from his interest in color to an interest in language understood as itself potentially non-conceptual, language of poetry, the language of translation, language that basically was a language that could not be understood in terms of conceptual meaning, but that had the capacity to, like a proper name, simply be at one with the object. But at least in the 19-teens, he understood color as perhaps having the same utopian potential.
Why did Benjamin study the quote-unquote non-utilitarian values of stamp collecting? And in his Timber Melancholy, why did he lament the prospective decline of the stamp, spurred by technological advancement? And what were additional causes for this decline?
Benjamin was fascinated with the minutiae of everyday life and sought to read the tea leaves, as it were, of the debris of a civilization that was on the wane, that now seemed to be passing, but needed somehow to be retrieved and even its utopian potential rescued. One example of this was his fascination with the postage stamp, which the surrealists like Louis Aragon had also found to be extraordinarily rich as a source of wonder. And Benjamin, in two basic respects, I think, found in postage stamps a potential for some sort of resistance to the world of getting and spending, the world of capitalist and industrial tyranny that he saw as part of modernity. First, stamps were in some ways a kind of physical and visual example of the possibility of the marvelous being contained in the micro world of small utilitarian phenomena. So you put a stamp on a letter to get it mailed, but each stamp has, at least it began to have at a certain point in its history, it had images that were images of history, images of the natural world, images of the exotic other. And as a result, stamps were, in a curious way, a little micro examples of the marvelous. They took, especially children who collected them, they took a child sitting in his bedroom, took him outside himself, living a world of potential fantasy, a world of the exotic, a world of exploration and of adventure. But secondly, stamps could be rescued from the utilitarian service. Their function as ways to mail letters could be collected. They could be collected, of course, for monetary purposes. They sometimes had value in that secondary sense outside of their value as ways to deliver mail. But they also could be simply collected by children, once again, usually by children, not always by them, as non-utilitarian ways to reorganize the world, to create new constellations of meaning, to create new aesthetic and non-functional ways of reorganizing the world. And I was a stamp collector myself as a child, and certainly Benjamin's understanding of the function of stamps was one that resonated with me. I understood the power of collecting as a kind of way to recreate or create for the first time through juxtaposition a world that had different meanings. But Benjamin was also very sensitive to the fact that this was a world that was on the wane. It was a world that was losing its power, partly because letter writing had lost its power, partly because the automation of stamps meant that you had a way to cancel them and to create stamp meters, and also because, although he did not live to see it, but we did, the replacement of letter writing through email and other types, texting and so forth, of communication. So this is a world that is now disappearing, the world of stamp collecting, the world of sending letters through stamps. And Benjamin, through his nostalgia for it, created in someone like myself a sense of mourning, we might say, or melancholy. I call it timbre melancholie rather than timbre mania. Timbre being the French word for stamp, which was used to describe the mania of collecting in the mid-19th century. Timbre melancholie, a loss of the sense of value in collecting stamps and creating this childhood hobby, which is now, alas, basically disappearing from the world.
Can you briefly elucidate the late Miriam Hansen's appraisal, however tenuous, of contributions by Siegfried Krakauer, Benjamin, and Adorno to the notion of quote-unquote counter-public spheres, rooted in sensory experience, as well as her skewing of Habermas's bourgeois public sphere? What is your own appraisal, especially given the rational critical dimensions of the discursive bourgeois public sphere and its disclosable language?
Miriam Hansen, who, alas, prematurely died about 8 or 10 years ago, very, very estimable theorist of film, a very close friend, much beloved by people at the University of Chicago and elsewhere, Germany, around the world, wrote an extraordinarily interesting book on cinema and experience, which brought Adorno into conversation with Benjamin and Krakauer on the issue of film. Adorno usually was understood to be simply hostile to film. She showed the extent to which she was seriously interested in film, not quite as much as Krakauer or Benjamin, but interested enough to make him part of a trio of critical theorists who were fascinated by the possibilities of film. And she used the theories of Oscar Naik and Alexander Kluge to make sense of what she saw as the counter-public sphere of film going, of film audiences who created through their collective solidarity of watching films a possibility of overcoming the individualism of bourgeois aesthetics and the individualism of bourgeois life. The counter-public sphere was created not through discourse, not through argumentation, not through the communicative interaction that Habermas had argued, but rather through shared sensuous experience in the cinema. So we all go to a comedy and we all laugh together. We go to a horror film, we all scream together. And I'm sure that we experience the difference between watching a film at home on television and one in the theater. And she argued that the latter created a kind of potential for a non-bourgeois countersphere, one that went against class distinction. Now, my own feeling was that this was a bit too ambitious, that the idea of a public sphere, and here I remain a bit more of a Habermasian than Miriam Hansen, the idea of a public sphere is one in which there has to be argumentation. Now, it depends what you're arguing about. A shared experience of going to the cinema gives people something to argue about and gives people a common background, a common vocabulary, you might say. But still, one has to have the space for critical rather than passive absorption of the material that is being argued about. So Krakauer in particular talked about the value of distraction. The modern cinema allowed you to experience something in a state of distraction. I was never quite as happy with that as I think Miriam was. I always thought that no distraction could also produce a passivity which ended by simply reinforcing the status quo or allowing you to be even manipulated. So I think you needed to have the added critical distance. And to this extent, I always thought that Habermas' notion of a public sphere in which argumentation, listening rather than simply viewing, capacity to weigh arguments and to be swayed by rather than manipulated by them, to be persuaded rather than manipulated, was absolutely crucial. So for that reason, although I found her expanded notion of a counter-public sphere based on Naked and Kruger suggestive, I resisted it to a certain extent because of my, let's call it, still Habermasian allegiances.
What were possible ironies at play in Herbert Marcuse's 1964 One-Dimensional Man? And why do you contend that he adopted a world historical narrative of stable irony that aimed for a two-dimensional pursuit of personal excellence, resistance to settled meetings and rhetorical eclipses, as well as the rise of more meaningful political engagement? And why did the media depict Marcuse as the guru of the new left? That's kind of a perennial question.
Habermas's One-Dimensional Man was an extraordinarily important book in my own first interest in critical theory. And the irony of the book, and this is what I point out at the beginning of this essay, the irony of the book is that it basically depicted a very bleak world in which the Marcuse, did I say Habermas? Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man was a book that appeared in 1964 at a time when I was first becoming interested in critical theory. The irony of the book's appearance was that it emerged at a moment when the New Left was just beginning to become a force in American politics. But the book itself emphasized the ways in which dissent, negation, critique had been absorbed by the system. Two-dimensionality had become one-dimensional, and we were all basically, if not robots, at least happily accepting of a kind of, you know, basically, well, what he called one-dimensional conformism. So the book is one that was contradicted by the reality of that moment. Now, what I tried to do in this particular essay is to figure out the role of irony itself in the book. And I go through several possibilities. One, a kind of cynical irony in which the world is basically, as it was in the Weimar Republic, a world in which all aspirations, all utopian goals were thwarted. And it was a world in which, you know, you basically had a kind of survival of the fittest, very cynical world that, say, Brecht showed in Three Penny Opera. The second version was a version of what might be called a universal irony based on the impossibility of language to accept, to be true to reality, one that informed the irony at post-structuralist deconstruction, the work, say, of Paul de Man emphasized, an irony which also was anti-utopian. Neither of these, I think, explain what Adorno or Horkheimer or certainly Marcuse felt was ironic about the current world. And although irony was difficult to maintain in a world which was fully one-dimensional, nonetheless, I think at the deepest level, Marcuse still held on to what might be called a stable notion of dramatic irony, in which, although he could know, and his assumed community of readers could know, that there was a potential for a different narrative, a more redemptive narrative, a narrative that was a narrative ultimately of emancipation, the world in which we lived was a world of false, one-dimensional, and ideological beliefs that were contrary to that larger narrative of utopian possibility. So Marcuse was still operating with the hope that he could read the world as a narrative, a single narrative of historical, potential historical redemption, one that, although the working class, the traditional Marxist analysis of the succession of feudal, bourgeois, socialist, and communist stages, that this was not one we could count on, nonetheless had the potential to go in the right direction. Now, my own feeling is that this is very difficult still to maintain, that this idea of a world historical narrative from which one can launch an ironic critique of a failed understanding of the participants in it today, it's very hard to maintain. So the only type of irony that is perhaps still plausible, and this is difficult to express in a soundbite form, is one which draws on the work of people like Christoph Menke and Jonathan Lear, which I try to spell out at the end of this essay, in which we know that there is no firm foundation in a larger narrative of redemption. We know that there is no single world historical meta-narrative of hope. That emancipatory narratives, like the ones Marx had held on to, Hegel had held on, these have now pretty much been destroyed. And yet, we must operate, or should operate at least, with an expectation that even though our hopes may be thwarted, even though our norms may not be utterly and completely groundable in universal categories, we nonetheless need to operate as if we had this goal in mind, as if we still believed in norms that we could not fully defend, as if we still believed that emancipation was possible, that we should not sink into the basically what I would call impotent ironism, which allows one to feel that all hopes are going to be defeated, all projects are going to be unsuccessful, all emancipatory projects will be basically thwarted. So it's a very modest version of irony, one that has still, I think, the potential to act with some energy towards heroic normative goals rather than simply resigned acceptance of the world as it, alas, must be.
To conclude the podcast, why do you believe that scholars should study the counter-enlightenment, especially given the alt-right's convolution of the Frankfurt School's quote-unquote authoritarian personality analysis, as well as the appropriation of quote-unquote leftist criticism of neoliberal ideas by none other than neoconservative Jewish commentators, among others? And how do your contentions relate, finally going back to the title, to Adorno's reconfiguration of the splinters in your eye aphorism and the splintered reality of devising a history of the Frankfurt School?
The last essay of the collection is two parts, basically. One written in 2011, when the first alt-right critique of the Frankfurt School as the source of political correctness and cultural Marxism became manifest to me. And then one written 8 or 9 years later, trying to bring it up to date. Now, the alt-right meme, which denies, which basically caricatures the Frankfurt School as a source of political correctness and cultural Marxism, is based on an extraordinarily narrow, distorted, and prejudiced version of its legacy. And I don't want to go into that now. It's been widely condemned, but not fully destroyed. And alas, one finds it still operative in the highest reaches of American political life, as I argue in the end of the addendum to that essay, by showing how much even members of the Trump administration have been affected by it. But be that as it may, the question you're asking concerns the counter-enlightenment and why it should be given a dialectical reading, why I talk about the dialectic of the counter-enlightenment. Well, first of all, the enlightenment itself, despite being simply emancipatory and productive, was understood by the Frankfurt School as in need of a dialectical, that is to say, a complicated pro and con, negative and positive assessment, and aspects that were emancipatory and aspects that were not. The reaction to it, the counter-enlightenment, is, I think, equally in need of a comparable dialectical critique. That is to say, why did this meme attacking the Frankfurt School occur? Why has the alt-right had so much success in the past decade? Why does Trump and Bolsonaro and Orban and other figures who have achieved such prominence in this past decade, why have they had the success they have had in the critique of globalization, critique of elitist appropriation of the globalization argument? Why have they had such success? Why has populism had such success? And I have no simple answer to this, but what I think we have to do is to take seriously the objections made to something like the authoritarian personality pathologization of the alt-right, because what it does is basically produce a kind of us versus them demonization of those with whom we disagree. Now, many of the people on the alt-right are, I think, in some, I suppose, metaphoric sense, truly demonizable. That is to say, they are racists, they are anti-Semites, they are irrational proto-fascists. And this small group, which earned the title of deplorables when Hillary Clinton was running for president, are people who are perhaps beyond redemption. And one can only have what we might call a strategic relationship to them. You have to fight them, and if possible, marginalize, destroy, and minimize the hurt that they will inflict on the rest of us, the way we had to fight fascism in World War II and have a kind of unconditional surrender attitude towards them. But this is a small group. The vast majority of people who supported Trump or support Bolsonaro and Orban are people whose agendas may be confused, but who may be reacting to pain, may be reacting to conditions which render them basically victims. And although I don't want to argue that we have to simply accept their self-description as victims as unimpeachable, nonetheless, we have to take seriously the pain they feel. And this comes back to the title of this collection, Splinters in Your Eye. The suffering that they feel is not suffering that we should simply dismiss. that we should simply say is illegitimate. That the suffering of the people who support the Trumps and Bolsonaros and Orbans of the world is also something that has to be understood and has to be dealt with rather than simply ignored. Now, I can't obviously give you the way to do that in the either in the short interview or in the book itself. But until we take seriously the suffering of the people who create the counter-enlightenment, until we give them the dignity of people who need to be listened to as well as dismissed, until we're able to be more inclusive than exclusive in our approach to them, we will end up with a kind of eternal polarization, which undermines the hopes for reconciliation that I think, at its most utopian, the Frankfurt School believed in. So what we need is a dialectic not of enlightenment, but also a dialectic of counter-enlightenment, which goes beyond simply dismissing them as deplorables, as authoritarian personalities, as neo-fascists, but being able sometimes to hear them in a way that allows them to feel that they are included and have the dignity that they so obviously crave and feel they have been denied by the elites of globalization, the elites of what, you know, basically had been a status quo that ignored their real grievances. So let me end with that. It's kind of ecumenical. It's a belief that critical theory can be used not only to verify and attack, to verify traditional leftist positions, but also to expand the reach of critical analysis to include an understanding of why people in other political traditions have felt aggrieved, and to try to figure out, and this is an extremely ambitious agenda, the ways in which we can include rather than simply dismiss and polarize political environment, which is, alas, descending into increased uncivil polarization. So let me perhaps finish with that utopian hope, and thank you very much for asking me these challenging questions.
One last question. What's next for you? I know that you're now emeritus. Is there anything on board for you next?
Well, I have actually in the moment a book in process called Genesis and Validity, which deals with the methodology of intellectual history and the way in which it interfaces with critical theory. And that's a book that's a dozen or so essays, which I've written over the past few years, which I think will come out with University of Pennsylvania Press in a couple of years. And then my final hope is to put together essays I've written and do a much more synthetic treatment of the idea of magical nominalism, which I touch on briefly here. I have several essays, including one on Adorno and musical nominalism, which tries to tease out the idea of magical nominalism. And that will be, I would imagine, my final large project. But I also, I'm very much stimulated by the possibility of writing on shorter exercises on contemporary issues, and have done a number of these recently. One on the Frankfurt School's notion of racket society, and Trump's work as a racketeer cum president, or president cum racketeer, and the film The Irishman, which was published a couple of months ago in the Los Angeles Review of Books. So that kind of much more timely writing is also, I hope, in the future. Thanks.
Well, we look forward to those projects. Sort of out of time now. This is Ryan Tripp, on behalf of New Books in History and Professor Martin Jay. The book is Splinters in Your Eye, Frankfurt School Provocations, out now by Verso. Please tune in next time.